Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, let's start out with, the first half of the program, at least, is going to be about, drumroll please, vaccinations. Vaccines on the horizons, vaccines on the chopping block, and vaccines that just might transform our lives. So let's start out with an experimental vaccine that prevents anaphylaxis, that deadly allergic reaction. And they have done it in mice. An experimental vaccine that protects genetically modified mice against severe allergic reactions for up to a year, so far, was published today in Science Translational Medicine. Scientists say findings show that the vaccination is a promising approach for preventing allergic reactions. The vaccine targets an antibody called immunoglobulin E, otherwise known as IgE, which when I'm trying to explain it to people, I say E is for emergency because this is the one that sends you to the ER. IgE is normally bound to immune cells in the body's tissues and in very small amounts in the blood. If you have parasites or allergic asthma, you'll have higher levels in your blood and you'll have stronger allergic reactions. Immune cells also provide IgE in response to proteins found on potential threats. So viruses, toxic substances, worms, blood flukes, as I said, parasites. And the antibody causes the cells in the body to release histamine. Histamine is a kind of a neurotransmitter. It's called a vasoactive amine, and it does things like dilate the capillary beds and make them leaky. It also tightens the airways, causing coughing, wheezing, and of course the dilated capillary beds cause hives and itching because histamine is an itch hormone as well. When you get too much histamine triggered, it can trigger a potentially fatal reaction, cause swelling of the tongue or throat, shock, in other words, so much leakage out of those capillaries that the blood pressure collapses, and difficulty breathing, both from swelling of the airway and also from spasm of the airway. So in people with allergies, what's going on here is that the IgG is being made inappropriately, not in response to parasites and viruses, but in response to pollen or dust mite poop or cat dander, mold. These are things that shouldn't be considered harmful, although mold is debatable, of course. This vaccine that they produced in mice will trigger the production of anti-antibodies. These are basically antibodies that are going to bind to the IgE and stop it from binding to the immune cell receptors, basically defanging it, so to speak. We already have an injectable monoclonal antibody, omalizumab, which has been used to treat food allergies, and there are a couple of others that are approved for asthma, but they all target IgE and lower the amount in the bloodstream. And so we've got the proof of concept that you can pull this off without ill effects. The only problem with the monoclonals is that they have to be given by injection. And so they require an injection every 2 weeks. And that's, well, you can imagine a shot every 2 weeks for the rest of your life and not feel so good about it. Now, these mice were special mice, genetically modified to be prone to severe allergic reactions. So when they had the experiment that was reported in Science, they had two groups of mice, nine that were unvaccinated by this particular compound and this antibody against antibodies, and nine who were vaccinated. And then they exposed them to a severe allergen, an allergen that would be likely to cause anaphylaxis. So eight of the nine unvaccinated control mice died within 30 minutes of exposure to this allergen. The vaccinated mice, on the other hand, just kind of sat there and scratched their butt, and they had a little itching, basically, but none of them died. And they maintained high levels of this antibody in their system for up to 52 weeks. That's as long as the study's been run. So now it's being published. We know that the vaccine lasts a year. We don't know how much longer it'll last. And it is, however, extraordinarily promising because even if this isn't every year vaccination, that is way better than getting a shot twice a week. These IgE attacking antibodies show real promise for the future of medicine. But in general, vaccines have been around for a very long time, and we have been modifying them over and over again to try to make them safer. There was a point in the history of the United States, not too distant past, when some vaccines had small amounts of mercury, a known toxin. Why would you do that? Why would you put a toxin in a vaccine, even in minuscule amounts? Well, the answer was to make sure that the immune system saw the thing you were trying to vaccinate again. This is a class of additives that are used in vaccines called adjuvants. Now, mercury is long gone out of the vaccine supply, but aluminum is used as one of the more common adjuvants. And I have a list here of several, but the aluminum is a nice irritant. Aluminum hydroxide will irritate the immune system, and the immune system will, once irritated, notice the thing you're trying to target that you're waving around saying, hey, look at this, attack this. But first you have to make the immune system a little bit angry. There are also oil and water emulsions and soaps, which is another kind of emulsion, and specific toll-like receptor agonists that are used. And they have, you know, classic names like ASO4, ASO3. The oil and water emulsions are primarily used, and you've had these, by the way, because these are used in flu vaccine to enhance the immune response. The toll-like receptor agents are used in hepatitis vaccines. So the Hep B vaccine and the human papillomas virus vaccine both use these types of adjuvants. And the reason they're in there is because if you just shot a small amount of inactivated hepatitis B virus or papillomavirus into the immune system, it would shrug and not mount an attack. So you have to, you know, hit the fire alarm with these adjuvants in order to get a vaccine to work. Virosomes, which are spherical particles made from lipids, and also little viral proteins thrown on there, they can be used as an adjuvant, and those are in development. And one of the ideas is to have harmless viruses, but viruses that are going to provoke an immune response, even though they've essentially been defanged, and use those. And that all of these would require extensive safety testing before they can be brought to bear. And that completely makes sense. Of course, you want everything to be very safe. Which brings us to on the chopping block part of this. The U.S. vaccine advisors are going to be meeting this week. This is the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This is mainly Robert Kennedy nominees, or rather not nominees, appointees, more accurately. And they're going to be taking a look at aluminum, the aluminum as an adjuvant. Now, I said we're trying to create new ones, but right now, adjuvants have been critical to vaccinations, and the adjuvants we've got are present in the measles vaccine, the DPT vaccine, which is the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine. They've been looked at for literally decades and decades. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has long campaigned in general about vaccines, and among other things, He's argued that aluminum adjuvants are linked to autism and food allergies. In July, researchers in Denmark published a study of more than a million children. That's a very sensitive study that found no such link. Kennedy immediately called for the study to be retracted. The journal declined. They're going to be looking at aluminum, and I don't trust their judgment. I'll put it that way. I think that they have a political hobby horse here to ride on vaccines, and I'm very worried that they're going to decide that aluminum should be removed. Now, what that is going to do to the vaccine supply and what it's going to do to children's health keeps me up at night. It really does. It seems almost as if this is the plan, because you're against vaccines. So the simplest way to get rid of them is to raise a regulatory hurdle, say, well, we've found evidence that this could be dangerous. We need to investigate. In the meantime, we're going to change the vaccine schedule and pull some or all of these vaccines until they are proven safe. In the meantime, of course, you will be exposing thousands, millions of children to the actual disease, which has been proven unsafe. Why not go back to the old vaccines? Well, the old vaccines used an entire organism, so they didn't need adjuvants. Nowadays, we use a little piece of the pathogen, a part of the virus, like the spike protein, or a part of the coat, the polysaccharide coat on the surface of the pneumonia virus to make the pneumonia vaccine. So that's good in the sense that it's less likely to cause a bad reaction, but it's not strong enough to cause a good reaction. So just let me tell you a little story about pertussis vaccine. So the DPT vaccine has been around for a very long time, and somewhere between around 15 years ago, it's absolutely established that if you give 50,000 children the pertussis vaccine, one of them will run a high fever and maybe even have convulsions, because high fevers do that in kids. And rarely, maybe one in a million, will actually have a persistent damage or even death from the reaction that they get. Now, that's terrible. So let's stop giving that vaccine. Well, they tried that in Japan, and the first year they lost like 5,000 children to pertussis or whooping cough, which is particularly bad in babies. And so they kind of said, well, you know, that's a lot more people, that's a lot more deaths than we thought we would see, because this one doesn't go away. It's, a lot of us have asymptomatic carriage of pertussis, and adults get pertussis, and they'll cough for 2 or 3 months, and, you know, cough so much they vomit. And in children, however, it can be lethal. So we came up with a new pertussis vaccine, because even, you know, one in a million deaths is still a death. So instead of using the entire pertussis organism, like the old vaccine, which was the killed vaccine, we took a small fragment of the surface of the pathogen, and this is a bacterial pathogen, and we used that, but it wasn't, and we had to put an adjuvant in to get it to work, and it worked. We got a spike in antibody levels, so we knew it had worked. But the problem was, the old pertussis vaccine, you got, I believe it was 3 or 4 shots, and you were good for life. You never needed to get the vaccine again. In the new, improved, safer vaccine, however, wears off after about 4 or 5 years. So that means by the time the child is 10 years old, they're quite vulnerable to getting a case of pertussis. They won't get it as bad, but they certainly can vector it to the new baby in the household, and so can adults. Hence the cocooning that pediatricians advise new mothers of, or at least mothers of a new baby, that everybody who comes in contact with that baby until they get their first shots needs to have been vaccinated within the last 2 years for pertussis using the new vaccine, which will wear off. So it's never simple, and there are always difficult questions involved. But we need these vaccines. Everything that we know about what happens when we stop, every time we stop, every time we slow down, even Canada has lost their designation as measles-free. The United States lost it a while ago. We now have these diseases back passing natively in the population. They may come in on a traveler, but they come in to stay. And with larger and larger proportions of the population either not vaccinated or under-vaccinated, this is like a pernicious weed. Once it gets its roots, down and distributed, it's so difficult to eradicate. And really, all you can do is strengthen the host. We're looking at a new malaria vaccine, and that's being deployed in Africa. That's working because of adjuvants. There's a tuberculosis vaccine that is in late-stage clinical testing that uses these more advanced adjuvants. But the validation process, the manufacturing, and the distribution, we need to make new friends but keep the old when we talk about vaccines. And speaking of new friends, a vaccine that keeps the opioid drug fentanyl out of the brain is about to start clinical trials in the Netherlands. The shot works by pairing a fentanyl-like molecule, just like the piece of the bacteria, right, in diphtheria, in pertussis, with a carrier protein, which is chunky enough to trigger the immune system to make antibodies, even though fentanyl isn't big enough for the immune system to see it. Once you add this chunky carrier protein, it is. Once primed, the immune system should attack any future fentanyl that enters the blood, preventing the high and the possibility of overdose, and a big benefit in places such as the United States, where more than 500,000 people have died of opiate overdoses since 2012. And I might add that the vast majority of current opiate overdose deaths are due to fentanyl. The vaccine could be suitable for people in addiction recovery programs and people who might be accidentally exposed to fentanyl because they're using other drugs. And I have a number of patients who use drugs and who have been unable to stop and have failed multiple recovery programs. And I make sure they have the fentanyl testing sticks that allow them to, when they do take something, they're able to make sure that it doesn't have fentanyl mixed in, because that pernicious thing has gotten firmly its roots down in this country. All right, so we're going to move on to our next story, and that one is also kind of a vaccination story in a way. This is vaccination via tick. So this is a report for the first alpha-gal death. A New Jersey man is believed to be the first documented death from alpha-gal syndrome. There is a protein called alpha-galactosidase, and it is found on the surface of meat, certain kinds of meat, beef being one of the ones. It's an unusual meat allergy, and it's triggered by tick bites. So the Western Lone Star tick is the species that most often spreads the alpha-gal. It feeds on an animal that makes it, like pork or beef, and then bites a human, and it regurgitates a little bit of the alpha-gal from its stomach into the human, and the human then forms antibodies. Now, so it's essentially a vaccination process via the tick. And of course, the tick saliva, I am sure, contains a lot of foreign proteins that will act as adjuvants. So the sensitization to this along-for-the-ride molecule takes place in a process exactly analogous to vaccination. Alpha-gal cases have increased substantially since 2010, probably because climate change is letting that Lone Star tick migrate northwards and have a larger range. And a lot of doctors have never heard of it. In fact, a 2023 survey of doctors were asked about it, and 42% said they'd never heard of it. Now, fun fact, I've been talking in the last few months about the xenotransplants with these genetically altered pigs that they've grown kidneys and functional kidneys in. And one of the genes they remove from the pigs in order to make them such that they won't be easily rejected by humans is alpha-gal. So, unfortunately, a New Jersey man died a few weeks ago. He's a 47-year-old airline pilot, and last summer he became badly sick after eating a steak, but he got better. 2 weeks later, after eating a hamburger, he was found unconscious in the bathroom, and paramedics were unable to revive him. The initial autopsy listed the case as sudden unexplained death, but blood tests later revealed extremely high levels of antibodies linked to alpha-gal, consistent with fatal anaphylaxis. The wife said, well, you know, he had a bunch of chigger bites earlier in the summer, but what many people actually believe to be chiggers can actually be the larvae of the Lone Star tick. So, something else to... something else to be alarmed about, but I thought it dovetailed really nicely with the discussion about immunization, because it is kind of immunization, isn't it? A single exercise session may slow cancer cell growth. And this isn't just in healthy people. It's also in people who've had cancer. This study just published is one of the ones that really went out of the way to demonstrate that you can be a cancer survivor and still benefit from the benefits of exercise. And it also helped underline how this benefit actually derives. So the research came out of the Exercise Medicine Research Institute at Edith Cowan University in Perth, Australia. Quoting Robert Newton, the senior author of the study, "Our work shows that exercise can directly influence cancer biology, suppressing tumor growth through powerful molecular signals." Past research has indicated that exercise helps some cancer survivors avoid recurrence of their disease. Other studies have been done looking at, this other study came out in New England Journal recently. It was done at Stanford. A large group of colon cancer survivors began a supervised exercise program that included frequent fast-paced walking and other more intense workout. A second group didn't exercise. 3 years later, the exercisers were 37% less likely to have experienced a cancer recurrence. That's better than what we see with many preventative drugs. Well, scientists have looked at how that could possibly be working, and we know that contracting muscles release a slew of hormones and biochemicals known as myokines into our bloodstreams. And it's long been suspected that myokines fight cancer. In previous studies to establish this what we would call proof of concept, done in both mice and healthy humans, blood drawn after exercise and added to a culture of live cancer cells killed or suppressed the cancer cells' growth. But those studies were not people who had survived cancer, and cancer survivors have gone through chemo. They've had a lot of treatments. It wasn't really clear if they would benefit as much. So these new studies are important. This one was done, the one that I'm really highlighting tonight, was done in women who were not currently exercisers, but were cleared medically to start working out, and who'd finished treatment with breast cancer. Those women were put on a high-intensity interval training. So half of them were working out, lifting weights. I should say that there was also a control group who didn't work out. Half of them were lifting weights. Half of them were doing high-intensity interval training. And immediately after the sessions and 30 minutes later, their blood was drawn, and they added plasma from that blood as well as the blood drawn before the exercise, that was the non-exercise comparison, to human breast cancer cells that were living and growing in petri dishes. And what they saw was drenched in plasma from either the interval trainers or the lifters, many cancer cells just quit growing and quite a few died. Blood drawn before exercise had no such effects. The effects were greatest with interval training, and that was because the interval training, high-intensity interval training specifically, 30 seconds at level 8 out of 10, and then 30 seconds resting, and then rinse and repeat, beneficial myokines, especially IL-6, a protein that affects immune responses and inflammation, a interleukin that was very important in COVID because how high your IL-6 levels were was a good predictor of whether you were going to survive if you were in the ICU. Too much inflammation is a bad thing. Just enough, really good thing. So the higher the IL-6 in the women's blood, the more effect it had on the cancer. Weight training was still potent. Newton believes that weight training remains the key to cancer fighting because people with cancer who increase their muscle mass through resistance experience greater rises in circulating myokines. And we've more muscle, more myokines. We've established with this research that exercise is an anti-cancer drug. So if you are a cancer survivor, and you are well enough to begin an exercise program, and please don't just jump in. Please be checked out by your doctor and approved to do this, and do it in a graded fashion so that you will be, and stick with it, because you're actually treating your cancer when you get out there and take a brisk 30-minute walk. If you can do like 2 miles in 30 minutes, that's the kind of speed that we're talking about to really get the full benefits here. Hello, this is Dr. Dawn. You're on the air. So yes. who are you and where are you calling from?
Chaz.
So Chaz. And mm-hmm. Are you from Santa Cruz, Monterey? Where are you from?
Scotts Valley.
Scotts Valley. Okay. Hello, Scotts Valley, Chaz. What's your question or comment?
Okay. Well, it's about COVID and mask wearing. But first, I just wanted to ask you if you remember talking about the pig to human heart transplant.
Yes.
Last week.
Was it that recently? Okay, but yes, I totally remember about it.
I hadn't heard about it, and I looked it up, and I found out that there was a pig transplant to a human, a pig heart to a human back in 2022, and unfortunately, the guy only lived for a couple months. So I don't know if they're improving on this since 2022.
I think that that was probably not the same immunosignal scrubbed pig that this latest research was done. So we have hopes that this will last longer because there's less immune attack.
Yeah, I also read that there was one successful pig heart to human transplant, but there was only one side effect that was troublesome. Every time he and his family walked in the woods, he would dig for truffles.
Yeah, I knew you were building. I knew you were building up to a joke there, Chad. I could tell. Okay.
Okay. Seriously, my question is, are you recommending folks this winter wear masks for COVID or B, flu?
It's contextual. So there are places where close quarters, where a lot of people are breathing and laughing and shouting, is probably a good place to put on a mask. And public restrooms are my number one place during cold and flu season to really, but COVID in particular, because COVID is excreted, an active virus that could, that can be infectious, is excreted in your stool. So if anybody flushes a toilet in that bathroom, unless the ventilation system is really, really good, those viral particles are going to remain in the air for a period of time, and to be breathing through just even a regular surgical mask is going to seriously reduce your exposure. And even though we have COVID vaccine, it doesn't keep you from getting COVID. It mostly keeps you from getting dead from COVID, which is, you know, definitely better. But you can still get a light case, and even light cases of COVID can cause long-term side effects. It's actually, as viruses go, it's a really evil virus, and it can do a lot of damage and inflame people, permanently or semi-permanently, which is, you know, seriously no bueno. With respect to vaccination, also, that's very important. If you are unvaccinated for any reason, or if you have immunosuppression so you're not able to be vaccinated, then you're looking at those really heavy N95 masks in public situations. And when you go into a hospital, any place where there are patients, you're now required, as of November 1st, you're required to be masked, because that's it. And that's a really good idea, because you're going to be potentially exposed to fairly high concentrations of stuff. It's impossible to completely clean the air in a hospital. And also, you know, these are sick people who really don't need a case of the flu on top of their, you know, abdominal wound, which will, you know, cough itself open. If, you know, it's just miserable to be sick and in the hospital and coughing.
Okay, well, so you're saying, in any bathroom, especially if you're going into a stall.
Public bathrooms, yes. Well, no, if you're going into a public bathroom, it's the air is everywhere. So if you're just going in to pee at a urinal, you probably still want a mask on.
Right.
And you know, if it's the stadium or the concert venue or an airport, the you know, especially any kind of transportation hub, you've got people coming in from all over the place and mixing. And so you're going to get exposed to new variations on things that you're sort of immune to, but the new variation may get past the fence, so to speak.
I see. I've just started wearing masks again as of November, and it's interesting. If I go into a grocery store, I probably myself and one or two other customers are wearing masks. So it seems like people are at least not yet worried about it.
Exactly. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for looking in the mirror and deciding how vulnerable you are. And, you know, you can kind of make a vulnerability index for pneumonia. And, you know, obviously you should have had, if you're over 50, you should have had your pneumonia vaccines. And I really think the flu vaccine annually is a very good idea. The COVID vaccine at this point annually is something I do. And I do that largely because I am in a hospital and it's my responsibility to do it. But if you have a sick relative, or you visit your, if you're, you know, routinely interacting with people in their 70s, you probably should, for their sake, be vaccinating. And that's the thing about this, you don't just vaccinate to keep yourself safe. You vaccinate to keep the people you love safe. And it's not dangerous. It's so much less dangerous than getting the infection. And that's why I don't understand is how that's hard for people to get. I just don't get that.
I don't either. So, Dr. Dawn, just real quickly, if you haven't had, if you've had a previous COVID series of shots and you haven't had one for a year and you want to get a booster, how long should you wait after getting that COVID booster to get, say, either a pneumonia shot or a flu shot? How long would you want to wait?
I love this question, especially on a show where we've talked about adjuvants. When you stack vaccines all at once, you're stacking adjuvants. So the two strongest adjuvant loads are the COVID vaccine and the shingles vaccine, Shingrix. And those things are really adjuvant heavy. So, for example, I'm like, yeah, go get your tetanus booster and your flu shot and your RSV. You can all get all of those, and you'll stack the adjuvants, so you'll be more tired and more sore, but not mm-hmm. drastically. But I would never recommend doing Shingrix and COVID together, because mm-hmm. that's just a big load of adjuvant. And the patients, I've had patients, more than one, who have done that because the pharmacy is like, yeah, and look, you're due for this one, and you're due for this one, and we can do all of these together right now, and they've mm-hmm. gone for it. But you just do not want to mix those two. 10 days is plenty, and
okay,
and so, 10 days is plenty. And my favorite preventative for feeling yucky for a day or two after a vaccine is a good sweat the night of the vaccine. So a hot bath with Epsom salts, and just stay in there until sweat's pouring off your face. Or if you have access to a sauna, go do the sauna. If you're an exerciser and can exercise yourself into a sweat, then do that. But you actually, it really blunts the irritation from the adjuvant, but it doesn't seem to in any way blunt the antibody take. I think the antibody, yes, I see it, no, I don't, that happens very quickly, right away. And the adjuvant, well, that's going to hang around for longer than it needs to be there. And so sweating it out is a great idea. And I think it really does reduce your risk of reactions from those very heavy adjuvant load vaccines.
Well, I thank you for all this really great information.
Well, you are very welcome, and keep listening there in Scotts Valley. Well, it's December 4th today, and I am not seeing the sun very much, just a little strip of blue sky. A couple of times a day when I open the door to let someone into my office, it feels like I'm living in the dark. Few people enjoy the gloom that comes with winter in the higher latitudes. And, of course, in up to a tenth of the population, long nights like this can trigger a type of depression called seasonal affective disorder. The exact physiology of this is unclear. People think it might be lower levels of melatonin, maybe a drop in serotonin, a disruption of the body's circadian clock. Antidepressants can help, but many people try to treat the root cause by buying gadgets that emit a bright light. And I've recommended these. There are little desk lamps. There's a kind of tablet on a stand. There are also visors. It's really tricky to test how well light therapy works because you have the power of suggestion and no real way to do a placebo. In a drug trial, it's very simple. You give some people their drug and some people a sugar pill, but you can't do that with light therapy because people are going to notice if they're being exposed to anything resembling daylight. And it's really only feasible to do this in institutions where you control their light exposure. But there are some research. This one was done at the Jingzhou Mental Health Center in China, which I bet is a residential facility. And they concluded that light therapy does seem to work. There was also a recent review article published in Romania, and it concluded between 60 and 90% of patients see some symptom remission with daily use. Those devices that emit predominantly blue, green, or white light all seem to have a similar impact. And, you know, I was taught that 10,000 lux was kind of the standard. That's outdoors on a nice day is about 10,000 lux. I have a little lux meter in my phone, and I get about 1,000 lux on an overcast rainy day, and about 10,000 if I get to clear sky and point it directly at the sun. So less intensive light, however, can work, and a good deal of research has gone into this. So if you're feeling sad and blue as you get through this time of day, Dr. Don recommends 5,000 units of vitamin D3 and getting morning light in your face. That's also a very good reaction for jet lag. Public health advice. We're switching topics, but we're staying on light. Public health advice over the last few decades has tended to emphasize avoiding the sun, seeking shade, and using sunscreen. But it may have gone a little bit too far, at least for people in the high altitudes. A growing body of research hints at health benefits from sunlight that go beyond vitamin D. These include protections against cancer, heart disease, and autoimmune diseases. There was a study published last year that looked at 360,000 light-skinned Brits and found that greater exposure to ultraviolet radiation, either from living in the sunnier southern bits of England rather than in the darker north, or from regularly using sunbeds, was correlated with either a 12 or a 15% lower risk of dying, even when the raised risk of skin cancer was taken into account. There was another study published by Pelle Lindquist from the Carolina Institute in Stockholm. She followed 30,000 Swedish women for 20 years and corrected for things like age, wealth, health. Sun-seeking behavior was associated with a lower chance of death from all causes. People with the most sun exposure had only half the risk of dying compared with those who had the least exposure. And this is very far north, so no exposure is really, really no exposure. The key is not to get sunburned. Interestingly, light skin is a secondary mutation. The early humans all had dark skin, and the light skin basically arose because of no ultraviolet radiation and a need to get some vitamin D. So having lighter skin meant that the melanin layer didn't bounce and absorb the ultraviolet rays. So instead, the higher levels of vitamin D were made deeper in the skin. And there's all sorts of increased benefits with high levels of vitamin D. I think that vitamin D supplements, if you're taking them orally, have to be taken for a very, very long time to show benefits. And when you look at that Swedish study, that was over 20 years. So when you read that vitamin D has failed to do X, look at the study design and look at how long they were on the vitamin D before they decided to call the study and say, well, there's no difference. And it's like, yeah, after 3 years. Yeah, after 5 years. No, I don't expect to see a difference in something like death or cancer, autoimmune disease, in that time frame. What I do expect to see is, and what we do see, is in fact a very strong location criteria for autoimmune diseases. The further north you go, the more autoimmune diseases, particularly multiple sclerosis, you see. And there's no other good reason for that except that they're not getting as much sun. Now, sun has many different other properties in the body besides raising vitamin D. One mechanism that's attracted a lot of attention recently involves nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a signaling molecule that, among other things, lowers blood pressure. And researchers in Germany way back in 2009 showed that UV radiation converts chemicals in the skin into nitric oxide, which is then absorbed through the lymph tissue and makes its way into the blood, and that whole body exposure to ultraviolet radiation caused a substantial drop in blood pressure fairly quickly. One 2017 paper showed an increase of 5 millimeters of mercury. So if your blood pressure is 120 over 80, let's say, and you drop it 5 millimeters, then it's 115 over 75, right? So for every 1,000 kilometers north of the equator, your blood pressure increases by 5 millimeters. And of course, death rates from heart disease are, in fact, higher in high altitude regions, high latitude countries, like Nordic countries. There's a striking seasonal pattern, with the death rates being much higher in the winter and much lower in the summer. Now, some of that is probably colder weather and dietary changes, but some of it is probably lack of sun. And we've talked already about the multiple sclerosis and the vitamin D. Another thing is lower rates of diabetes, and evidence from mice also implicates nitric oxide for this. And a lack of sunlight is thought to be an important reason why in some Asian cities, more than 80% of children now need glasses. Bright light, the sort that is hard to generate indoors, appears vital to regulating the growth of children's eyes. So my big question, and it's an unanswered question, is did the adaptation to lighter skin, having lower amounts of melanin in the skin, what else did that do? Because one thing we don't see in dark-skinned women with low vitamin D levels is we don't see osteoporosis. Something else is at work here that we've yet to identify. And that's what makes science so interesting and why it's my favorite topic of conversation, to the point of boring my family senseless, is I just really appreciate being surprised. But just a moment, I'm going to send you off with a quickie. Microbiologists in Denmark have been making a healthier kind of yogurt by fermenting the milk with live ants. It turns out there's this very fancy restaurant and that calls itself Part Science Lab, and it's in it's in Copenhagen. So if you're ever there, be sure you check it out. It's called Alchemist. Anyway, there's an old Bulgarian practice that uses live red wood ants to induce fermentation. And so they got themselves some ants. And by the way, freeze-dried, dehydrated ants doesn't work. You really need live ants. And they were able to make yogurt, cheese, an ice cream, and the acidity of the ant, as one foodie said, because you have the acidity of the ants, which is lemony, but a tad bit more complex than lemony. The ant products also contain far more beneficial microbes than commercial yogurt. And just be careful, because you really can't just go round up some ants locally. Apparently, ants can carry parasites that are dangerous to humans. But I hope you enjoyed that. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.